Welcome to Writing the Wrong Way, where we talk about how writing works, how writers work, and why the best writers risk being strange. And I have a bit of a series that I want to do here where I'm going to talk through some movies, what sort of works and doesn't work in the construction of these movies. And I'm going to start with Jack and Jill. That's right, the Adam Sandler film. Jack and Jill, where Adam Sandler plays both Jack and Jill, widely regarded as one of the worst movies ever written, ever made. So why might you want to watch Jack and Jill and study Jack and Jill if you are a writer trying to write something good, either a good screenplay or even just a good prose fiction, a good novel? What can we learn as writers from Jack and Jill? Well, I think there's two things that we can learn. Number one, of course, we can learn what not to do. It's often very instructive to look at examples that don't work when you're looking at fiction, film, stories of any type. What doesn't work and why doesn't it work? Something that's bad, we often can see more clearly why it's bad. Whereas something that's very, very good, often stories that are well constructed or trying to hide their construction as part of their craft, you know, they're trying to get you to go along with it, suspend your disbelief and so on. All the cliches of getting immersed and wrapped up in a story, well, those are actually, if that's happening to you, you know, if you really are getting drawn into a story, it's because the writer has constructed, or the filmmakers, if it's a movie, have constructed the text in such a way that you're not noticing its construction. You know, they've done a very good job of hiding the construction. But in a bad example, in a bad story, a bad movie, a bad novel, the writer just doesn't have the ability on some level, or just has failed to do this. The writer has failed to do the work properly of hiding from you how the thing is constructed. In fact, how it's constructed keeps getting in the way of your enjoyment of it. So for that reason, bad examples I find are really great. Also, I got to say, I do kind of have a pleasure that I get out of watching Jack and Jill. I really do recommend you watch Jack and Jill if you're a writer trying to learn how to write movies or write anything, because one is so bad, it's unreal, and it's just sort of fun and fascinating on that level. But two, there's actually a lot of good stuff buried in Jack and Jill. And so I will go through some of that as well and sort of give this film a little bit of the credit that maybe it, for good reasons, hasn't gotten. So come with me, you know, as we learn what there is to learn from Adam Sandler's movie, Jack and Jill.
In every family, there's one person who drives you a little crazy.
I gotta pick Jill up at 4 a.m.
She comes once a year and she's leaving on Sunday.
However, there's no escaping it when it's your sister.
How we doing?
Your twin sister.
Are you going bald?
Huh?
No, you're getting fatter and your hair doesn't realize it needs to cover more face.
Okay.
From the producers of Just Go With It and Grown Ups.
And Jill are so alike.
We are nothing alike, I promise you.
She isn't shy.
Truth!
And she isn't leaving.
I put a little list together of things I want to do.
Beach, horseback riding.
Let's go! Oh my God!
Seriously, honey, can't you try a little harder? She's your sister.
Please don't destroy my pool.
Construction of Jack and Jill is fundamentally baffling. It is perhaps one of the most poorly constructed films that I've ever seen. I like to teach it and use it as an example of in writing classes because it's so fundamentally misfiring in fundamental ways. And yet, Jack and Jill has within it almost everything that you would need in order to succeed. It has a fundamentally simple, clear premise, very high concept premise. The premise, of course, you know, is classic, you know, comedy vehicle premise. We have the idea that Jack and his twin sister Jill are in a situation, a dynamic, a relationship dynamic where, you know, Jill loves Jack. Jack can't stand Jill, finds her annoying. So all that was required for comedy to develop, all that we need to do is get a cast of people around this premise, get Jack and Jill in a room. Jack wants to get rid of Jill, but of course, you know, it's the holidays, like all families, right? You know, that maybe don't see eye to eye are stuck together for the holidays. They compound the situation. Not only does Jill, you know, live across town, you know, she lives far enough away, she's got to fly in, you know, Jill is arriving for the holidays, right? And then we start to get, as the film goes on, these little developments and escalation of that conflict. You know, Jill has come on an open-ended ticket. She doesn't have a clear return date. And she intends to stay, to overstay her welcome. Jill, of course, you know, is thinking that, you know, Jack won't mind. Well, she realizes he would mind, but, you know, she wants to stay. She's hoping to kind of turn him around. We have a situation that has so much simplicity to it, and then they have to sort of add these interesting layers of development. You know, they've had this all, they've got Al Pacino somehow. They've got this whole subplot with Al Pacino, which I'll get into in a minute, which is a fascinating subplot in various ways. But everything that's the overall shape of this story, I want to point out, is very excellent, brilliant, simple shape. And it should work. Jack can't stand his sister Jill, but she's there for the holidays. As the holidays go on, it becomes clear that she doesn't intend to leave when they're over. She moves into a situation where she's an interminable guest staying indefinitely, but there is a clock. If Jack doesn't get rid of Jill before, you know, the New Year's, then she's going to end up coming on their cruise with them. Once they're on the cruise, not only is his cruise ruined because of the presence of Jill, but he's now in a situation where he cannot, because of it being a cruise ship, he's stuck on the ship with Jill, can't get off the ship. So it's a perfect storm of a plot. On top of this, he needs to perform an impossible feat. Get Al Pacino to be in a Dunkin' Donuts commercial. If he doesn't get Al Pacino to be in a Dunkin' Donuts commercial, then his business goes under. And if his business goes under, of course, you know, all these people, not only is his family going to be affected, but all the people who work for him are affected, and so on and so forth. So he has this in particular need to eventually, as Al Pacino becomes attracted to Jill and wants, you know, we have the escalation of the Al Pacino subplot where it starts to intersect with the Jack and Jill conflict plot. And we have precise, this brilliant situation now where he has to get Jill to stay and hook her up with Al Pacino. But Jill inexplicably doesn't want to, you know, date Al Pacino. And, you know, now he's kind of torn in this horrible situation. If he keeps Jill, you know, she's the key maybe to getting Al Pacino and getting these other things that he wants and needs. But if he gets rid of Jill, you know, if he keeps her, of course, you know, he's not going to get rid of her, right? So it's an interesting sort of predicament that he finds himself in. There's all sorts of comic potential in this thing. And the whole reversal of that, you know, trying to get rid of Jill and then having to kind of keep her around, but then not too long and so on, is a great tightrope that character has to watch, and a great set of dynamics. It's all set up and structured well for comedy, but what they've done is fundamentally paced it wrong. One, they put all of these moments in the wrong spot. This is cordoning off the Pacino subplot for a second, because I'll get back to that, but like all these moments are actually in the wrong position. And on top of that, all the great parts of the script and or the great, you know, structural elements of the plot have been completely mishandled. Let's just take a look at the cruise ship, for example. The genius of the cruise ship from the point of view of plotting is that once, if Jill makes it onto the cruise ship, then they're stuck together. They're stuck in a short and an even smaller confined space where he can't leave, even temporarily. It's a great idea, but note what happens. They trammel this situation towards the cruise ship. Almost as soon as they get on the cruise ship, he gets a call from Al Pacino. Pacino flies him out on a helicopter. So now he can leave the cruise ship, completely diffusing and negating the whole situation of the cruise ship. You know, the point of the cruise ship is that they're confined on a cruise ship together and they can't be free of one another. But the Pacino helicopter thing negates that. What they should do, of course, is have Pacino on the cruise ship, right? The other thing that happens on the cruise ship, notice that not only does he need Pacino to, you know, he gets away because Pacino comes and picks him up in a helicopter as he addresses Jill and all this stuff. But then notice what happened after Jill's talked to him on the phone and he comes back to the cruise ship and he wants to apologize to Jill. He's told that she's already left. How does she leave? How does she get off the cruise ship? Do you see? They completely, the cruise ship is such a great concept and has so much promise and potential. It's an innate escalation of the core conflict that the proximity to Jill is creating stress and anxiety in his life. And all the good parts of that, plotting wise, structurally speaking, they just immediately negate by having, apparently, it being super easy, inexplicably easy, to remove oneself from the cruise ship. On top of all this, if we backtrack a bit, note that I say the premise has this inherent comic potential. It has a really, if you like Adam Sandler, and you want to see Adam Sandler playing two people, right? You know, Eddie Murphy style, you know, where there's a whole tradition of comedies in comedy of mainstream comedies of these popular comic actors playing multiple roles in the same movie. If that's the movie you are interested in, signed up to see, right? Again, this is a high concept. Jack and Jill, Jack can't stand Jill, but Jill's here. Jack has to get rid of Jill. I want you to just think for 1 minute. Just stop and sit and think. I'll give like a little bit of space in this video for you to do this. Think for a second of, try to think of one thing that Jack does to try to get rid of Jill. One thing. There is, in fact, one thing, precisely one thing that he does, which is that he tells her, he yells at her in Thanksgiving supper. That's it. That's literally the only thing in the entire movie that Jack actually does to try to get rid of Jill. In fact, if you look closely at the movie, almost everything he does ends up keeping Jill there, or would, if it worked, have the desired the effect of keeping Jill there. Now, it may seem like this would make sense after the point where it becomes clear that Al Pacino is interested in Jill and now he's got to somehow get her hooked up with Al Pacino. But even before that point, the things that he does, like trying to find Jill a date, imagine if that had gone well. He signs Jill up to the dating site, then eventually puts her on Craigslist and so on. The logic he has here is that, well, if Jill had a, you know, partner, someone else to be with, she wouldn't want to be around here. But what's the thing of the flaw of that logic? Of course, you know, Jill lives in another place entirely. So if, in fact, he did find Jill somebody else to be with, she would have to move to his locale. it's such a violation of the high concept. Because keep in mind, like, and this is where we start to get into something that's just fundamentally the problem with Jack and Jill, which is that it doesn't understand its audience and what its audience wants. And you'd think that Adam Sandler would know this by now. Here's a movie that has promised us hijinks, has promised us, you know, what you're going to see in this movie is Jack trying to get rid of Jill and never once delivers on that idea. It's not even that it has unfunny jokes. It doesn't even make a joke in this line of activity. He just doesn't do anything to try to get rid of Jill. The other more extreme example of the audience mismatch is very hard to see, but it is weirdly connected to the best thing about this movie, which is Al Pacino. That whole Al Pacino plot, which culminates in Dunkachino, this brilliant, stunning, you know, ending to this otherwise brutal film. That subplot, if you pay very close attention to Jack and Jill, is a fundamentally baffling inclusion in this movie. And not just because of Al Pacino and kind of the question of why is Al Pacino in this Adam Sandler movie that has gone off the rails almost the moment it began. There's a lot of small things in this movie, like why is Jill wearing a trench coat all of a sudden, and, you know, with a bra underneath it and nothing else in the one breakfast scene. If you look, why is Jill running in the woods? There's a number of just weird infidelities in this, which are a result of them realizing in the edit how bad this movie is and just trying to salvage it, but strangely making it worse. So for example, what they did at one point was they cut out a scene where she puts on the trench coat. They cut the scene where she puts it on out, but they keep in the scene where she's wearing it afterwards. So now she's just inexplicably doing, you know, wearing this bizarre costume and never ever's attention even drawn to it, which makes it stranger. You have another moment where she starts, where she's, you know, wakes, she's woken up after sleeping in the woods. And they start to talk about a scene that took place the night before, which the filmmakers never showed us. So it's kind of confusing why she's there, but then we get sort of a bit of the information about it. It's like, well, you know, I came home and this happened, this happened. It's like, but we never saw any of that stuff. So it's just fundamentally, you know, this is a film that is just impossibly broken and terrifyingly poorly constructed. But jump to the Al Pacino subplot again for a second. If you watch this film multiple times and you pick up a really subtle, you know, cues, you can piece together what the Al Pacino subplot is. And it's actually quite brilliant. Unfortunately, it is sort of brilliant in the way that kind of makes no sense for a for an Adam Sandler movie. So in case, you know, you didn't catch it, which of course you couldn't. And by the way, it's not possible to determine this is happening on the first viewing of this film. The actual information that lets you piece this plot together, the way I'm going to describe it now, like I'm describing it after the fact, the information that I'm going to give to you is in the reverse order in the film. So you can't actually understand the early moments in the subplot until after you've seen the later moments in the subplot. You just don't, as an audience member, have the information available to you. But what has happened is this. Al Pacino has been offered the role of Don Quixote in Man of La Mancha, the musical, based on the novel Don Quixote. Al Pacino is trying to decide, because he's a method actor, who has an immersive process, he is trying to determine, will I take the role? On one hand, he would like to take the role, but on the other hand, he can't take the role, really, until he has kind of gotten into the mindset of the character. And he's having a hard time getting the mindset of this character, because if you know the novel Don Quixote, now keep in mind, this is the Adam Sandler film audience we're talking about. Were you to be a big Adam Sandler fan, and also you happen to know intimately the novel Don Quixote by Cervantes, then you would know that Don Quixote is a character who, a commoner who becomes, who reads too many novels and who becomes enraptured with this idea of charity. He begins to sort of slowly unravel mentally. And as he's losing his mind, as it were, he begins to become obsessed with this, prostitute, essentially, this low-class prostitute. And he begins to sort of imagine that she is this, very upper-class, princess-like figure called Dulcinea. So he kind of mistakes this woman, this crass, low-class prostitute for Dulcinea. Medieval France almost, not precisely, but roughly when this thing is being set. It's after the time of medieval France, but we're sort of, Don Quixote is kind of imagining himself in that milieu. He imagines himself a knight. He imagines her as sort of the princess that needs saving. He becomes obsessed with her and he begins unraveling. And everyone else kind of wonders, what's Don Quixote doing? Why is he so obsessed with this woman who just, clearly doesn't seem to warrant the attention he's paying to her? Well, Pacino, trying to get in the mindset of Don Quixote, unable to do so, but then he sees his Dulcinea, right? Again, keep in mind, none of this information is available to you. When Pacino says Dulcinea in the film, at that point, it's not possible to know unless you recognize the name Dulcinea as being from Don Quixote and therefore Man of La Mancha, and you have a knowledge of that plot. You can't pick up on it. But at that point, Pacino, again, we've seen he's kind of started to lose it a little bit because he's trying to get, he's doing Richard III, but he's trying to get in the headset of, headspace of in Don Quixote. It's not quite working. So there's this dissonance. Pacino's sort of unraveling. As he's unraveling, he sees this woman, Jill. He kind of, like Don Quixote, recognizes her as his Dulcinea, becomes obsessed with her and pursuing her. Eventually, all these, the fact that he tries to bring her to a castle, like all these things are like the things that, there's very subtle moments in the film where, again, in an Adam Sandler film where subtlety has no place, we have these very subtle moments where this very complicated, highly literary subplot is being developed. Eventually, this culminates, of course, in the very end of the film, where Jack and Jill are kind of in the bar, and there's this whole altercation. Pacino comes in dressed in full knight regalia with a spear and starts to stab at the ceiling fan. This is a reference to the part of Don Quixote where he tilts at the windmill. He attacks, he believes this windmill that he sees, in his derangement. He thinks it's some sort of monster, and he tries to attack the windmill. Try to piece all that together and try to imagine who and how it was determined that the audience for Jack and Jill, where Adam Sandler plays two siblings, one in drag, that audience apparently is being trusted to pick up on subtle developments in a subplot mirroring the plot of the novel Don Quixote. piece that and the other sort of strange oddities of this film together, if you will. Again, a film that has fundamentally within it everything you need to make an exceptional comedy. It's even got Norm Macdonald and Al Pacino.
Compliments to Mr. Pacino.
What?
This is insane, man. You gotta call him.
From Columbia Pictures.
All you gotta do is make contact.
That's what.
Oh! Oh! Oh my God! I'm sure you have others.
You'd think it, but oddly enough, I don't.
What is it that you see in my sister?
I see a girl who wants recognition, but never gets it.
Family is forever.
Daddy, you know how to jump rope?
We were the double dutch king.
Adam Sandler is Jack and Jill.
One thing Jack and Jill actually does surprisingly well is illustrate a character's journey throughout a film. So Jack, when the film begins, is completely annoyed, frustrated by Jill, can't stand Jill, can't get along with her, has a hard time feeling how he knows he's supposed to feel towards his sister. And what exacerbates this situation even worse for him is that nobody around him, you know, no one else in the family here, seems to see Jill the way that he sees Jill. He views this as being a disconnect produced from the fact that he doesn't know, or they don't know Jill as well as he knows Jill. You know, they haven't grown up with Jill. They haven't had to spend as much time together with her. Therefore, you know, they see her as, you know, in a more positive light than he can manage to view her. And then as the film goes on, he becomes progressively more frustrated by this seeming disconnect. Does no one else understand that Jill is this annoying? You know, this reaches this height with Al Pacino, where Al Pacino becomes, you know, kind of obsessed with Jill. Jack ascribes this to the, he can't understand it at all, but he ascribes it. He sees the explanation in, well, you know, Pacino's losing his mind. Everybody kind of has seen this on social media, and now, you know, they're seeing it. He's seeing it up close. And then, of course, as the film goes on, you know, this intensifies, you know, as people become more and more accepting of Jill, and as Pacino becomes more and more obsessed with Jill, Jack finds her more and more aggravating and has a harder and harder time kind of understanding where anyone, even keeping himself under control around Jill. Eventually, of course, what he has to do, because he's so alienated Jill and so disconnected himself from her world, he can't deliver her to Pacino as promised. So he has to pretend to be Jill. Here's where the big, you know, premise of the film pays off. The fact that they look alike, supposedly. He's been sort of ignoring their likeness. There's that scene in the movie theater where he tries to deny that they have any similarity. And yet, of course, we can see it. Now he has to pretend to be Jill. He dresses up as Jill. He, you know, dupes Pacino into thinking that he's Jill. In that whole complicated, you know, strange scene, Pacino actually kind of explains, you know, finally to Jack, you know, what it is that he sees in Jill. He sort of indicates, you know, well, look at, you know, Jack from Jill's point of view. And he, you know, illustrates for Jack for the first time all the things that Jill couldn't articulate because she was too nice and she just, you know, loved her brother too much to say to him how she really, how her life had really been because of Jack and how he had kind of always gotten the attention that she didn't have. And she never, you know, begrudged him it, but, you know, it was sort of a lack in her life. Luckily, she had Jack to fill that lack, but that's what hurt so much when Jack, you know, pushed her away. So finally, Jack gets to see Jill from Jill's point of view through, of course, the intermediary of Al Pacino. By becoming Jill, right? By inhabiting her clothes, and then later her perspective, Jack finally gains a correct understanding of Jill. He starts to see her as others see her, and then finally starts to develop the brotherly love that he had had along. It's a brilliant and carefully and well-constructed character journey nestled inside this film that is, you know, otherwise complete mess.
This has been Jonathan Ball talking about Writing the Wrong Way. I hope this has been useful to everyone, and I hope you keep writing the wrong way.